We're going to go ahead and get started. Welcome, everyone. Glad you're here. We're on lesson four tonight. Really appreciate everyone coming on Wednesday night. I know it's difficult, the traffic. At least it didn't rain tonight, but I know a lot of you spent a long time in the car getting here, so I appreciate that. And hopefully we can have a good study and you can get something out of the class as we go through the material. If you're visiting, don't see a lot of visitors, but if you're visiting, glad you're here. If you're listening online, same as well. We are continuing. We're on lesson four. We are right in the midst of kind of this reaction to these great gifts that we have from this great plan of salvation that we talked about, I guess you talked about with Larry last Wednesday night. It would be tempting and kind of nice to just spend the entire class talking about this great plan of salvation and the great blessing of salvation. But Peter moves on, and so we've moved on as well. And we talked about on Sunday some of the products of that salvation. Tonight we're going to start talking a little bit more about like duties and responsibilities as saved believers. So we know who Christ is. We know all the great things he's done for us. So what kind of change and reaction does that make in our life? So we're going to start with a little bit of a review. And then we're going to get pretty quickly because I into chapter 3. I did not get as far as I wanted to on Sunday. But please keep your questions coming. The class is only good if people are participating. So by way of review, this was kind of the pivotal verse here in 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 13, where he talks about the fact that we have this great hope that's resting fully on grace. And grace was one of the products of salvation that we learned about a week ago tonight. But we also talked very quickly there in verse 14. He also admonished them for obedience. He admonished them to be changed people, so do things differently than they did before. And he also talked to them about being holy and aspiring to being holy. Then he continues on with this theme of live in fear or have fear, which again seems a little bit strange. The fact that we've got this great hope and it's firmly rooted. We understand obedience and holiness, but we have fear. Who remembers the two kind of drivers or motivators for this fear that we need to have? The judgment to come, and specifically, what about that judgment? Who, the person sitting in judgment, what's the characteristic or attribute of that person? Completely holy, yeah. So he has the ultimate standard. And I think we read and talked about on Sunday's class a little bit, he's also impartial. So again, that seems like a strange thing. Why should I be impartial? Well, he knows exactly what you've done and what you haven't done. And there are no special favors. We talked about it. If you were a Jewish person, that didn't get you anything special with God. Regardless of who your family is, what church you say you belong to, whatever, it's you and God transparently with what you've done. There's no special favors with God and no partiality, which can be a good thing, but can also be fearful. What was the other thing, the other reason why there's an element of fear here? Yeah, the great sacrifice and salvation, right? So I kind of said on Sunday, first of all, we're guilty, and we're guilty in a direct way with the judge, right? It was his son that our sins put to death. So we have to take seriously the benefit of salvation that Christ offered to us and that God offered to us through his son. Okay, but last but not least, verse 22, that we're also supposed to have love for each other, a fervent love for each other. So it also is important that we have the right relationship with each other. So I think that is a pretty good review. I'm going to kind of do it in a block diagram format. I know a lot of people tell me they're visual learners, so I'm going to try and put this in one slide to summarize the first part of the first chapter. We've got, I don't know if that showed up very well. It didn't. I'm sorry. I can change the colors. We've got all the great things that we have through Christ and the gift of salvation that he's given for us. Through that, we have this desire or this imperative to be obedient, be new creatures, to be holy, to have some fear, and to love each other. And based on all of that, that's where our hope is of salvation, our foundation. So that takes us pretty much through chapter 1. Before we go any further, I've asked John to lead our minds in prayer to get us started here in class. Amen. All right, the next slide is a busy one, so I will try and let you know that my intention in here tonight is not for you to understand everything on the slide. I'm actually going to make a handout of this slide so you can look at it later, but I want to try and explain what this chart is so you understand it when you see it in the lesson material on the table. There are really like three critical overviews or graphics for the first couple chapters of 1 Peter, and this is one of them. So it is a summary of everything that we talked about here, right? It's kind of the cause and effect. In this first category, we have salvation and then the products of that and what that causes as far as change in our life. Left-hand side, we have judgment, and we know what that judgment will bring in us, or that we will have some level of fear knowing that that's coming. Understanding the preciousness of Christ's blood also causes us to have love for each other, seeing the love that he had for us. We have this purification in your souls through the obedience of truth, and that we'd want to put away things in the past, and that we would have a desire to grow. We covered this one on Sunday as well. Having been begotten together again by the word, in verse 23, that we will now build ourselves up as spiritual sacrifices. I'm just going to put the last couple up here as well here. So this, you're going to see, and this is one of the key things that kind of summarizes the first chapter. Maybe it's helpful for you, maybe not, but you've got it, and you will have it in the lesson pack for Sunday. All right, so verses 1 through 10 in chapter 2 are the verses that I did not get to cover on Sunday because I was a little bit behind, actually a lot behind. But I'm going to try and summarize this. It really hinges on the first verse here. So after all these things happen, Peter has another one of his therefore statements. So he's saying, now that you are Christians and that you have chosen to take part in this great gift of salvation, you've adopted Christ as your Savior, now you need to continue and grow and continue to do these things. So it's a transition verse. And then verses 2 through 10, he talks about how Christ, again, is the foundation. If you remember our chart with Christ kind of at the bottom, it's the foundation of all of our hopes and all of our dreams and everything that we are doing. But we as Christians have made a choice to accept Christ as our chief cornerstone versus rejecting him. That's about as good a summary as I can give you for the first 10 verses, but we're not going to get much deeper into them than that. Now, verse 11 starts really where we should begin our class tonight, and I'm just going to put them up here on the screen, and I'll read this, understanding that a lot of people may not have had a chance to look at their lessons, but again, it's a transition into a new line of thinking, some new instructions for the reader. So, 1 Peter chapter 2, beginning in verse 11. Beloved, I urge you as aliens and strangers to abstain from fleshly lust, which war against the soul. Keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in the day in which they slander you as evildoers, they may, because of your good deeds, as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation. So there's some more instruction going on here, specifically have this kind of renewed call to keep clean from fleshly lust, excellent behavior, good deeds. But what is the goal that he's trying to accomplish by saying these things? Some of these things he's already said in terms of behavior for us as Christians. Who and what are we trying to affect by acting this way? Joe? Good, trying to become more like God, more holy, that's right. And what's going to happen as a result of that, Danny? Yeah, we want God to be glorified. Yeah, thank you. We're on TV, if you will. People are watching Christians. People are watching Christians today. People are watching Christians then. So if you kind of look at these key words, so that they may glorify God. The goal here is that we're certainly glorifying God, but the goal is that others are also glorifying God as well. So this may be a little bit challenging here. We think about our own lives. We think about what's happened in the first chapter. We're certainly accepting Christ. We're believing. We're putting our hope on Him. We're obeying. We're changing our lives. We're showing love to other people. But now Peter introduces this idea that other people's salvation and relationship with God can be affected by your walk as a Christian. That's pretty challenging. It's very important for us to realize, and certainly important for them to realize as well. He also gives us a little glimpse of what's coming later in chapter 3 with these persecutions and these slanderings that are going to come up. Are Christians slandered as evildoers today? And if so, how? Sure. Yeah, so that's a quick one that usually comes out. Christians in general are judgmental. Maybe there are some Christians that are judgmental, but that's a label that usually goes out pretty quickly. Someone else? Joel? Yeah, exactly. You just want everybody to be like you. Yes. Exactly. Yes, sir. Sure. Yeah, so maybe you're striving for holiness and doing the right thing is perceived as trying to be self-righteous or self-elevating, so a Christian might be slandered for that. It's a good one. It's another one. You ever heard of Christians commonly referred to as like being hypocritical? Maybe they are hypocritical, but that seems to be a label that goes pretty broadly applied as well. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of things, but at this point in time, people heard things about Christianity, like people hear things about Christianity today, and the people around these Christians didn't really understand what it meant to be a Christian. They, as often happened, had heard all the bad stuff and not the good stuff, right? So Peter's admonishment here is that people are watching, and when people do slander you, hopefully they'll remember back to the way you lived your life and your character, and that they might be able to glorify God. How might these non-believers might be able to glorify God by your conduct? Is it possible they might ask you about your beliefs and actually become a follower as well? I think that's the intention and the hope here, that these folks that are hurling insults at Christians and slandering Christians can actually be affected in a way that they are also glorifying God. Okay, comments or questions on these? These are the two intro verses, but they're pretty pivotal as we think about everything else that comes after these. Yeah, Ronnie. Yeah. Yeah, so day of visitation is an interesting phrase. And from what I've been able to find on that is basically when God makes himself known to man. So that might be for the case of the evildoers. Hopefully that is God making himself known to man through the sharing of the gospel. So this person that is slandering you, this evildoer, has now got a chance to hear about the gospel. And hopefully maybe that's coming from you. And they're understanding God, they're meeting God for the first time, they may also rejoice and bring Glory to God. I think so. I think that's the ultimate goal. From a practical standpoint here, I think the first step would be for them to understand that their criticism of you as a Christian and the slander was unmerited. I think that would be step one. Step two might be them trying to inquire, why is this person acting this way, doing these good deeds, living this righteous way, and continuing to serve God even when I'm saying evil things about them? And then step two might be understanding God a little bit more. Does that make sense? Go ahead. I would say yes, except with the everyone, right? So none of us should be believing that we can change the perception of everyone about Christians. Practically, that's not going to happen. But if you're in a situation or circumstance and the people that are close to you see you, maybe the people at work, in your social setting or whatever, are saying these slanderous things against you, over time, they're going to see your pattern of behavior. And they're going to take pause with that, right? If someone just runs into you one time and says something evil about you as a Christian, they're not going to have a chance to see that you've done these good deeds and you're living a righteous life. So I think the context and setting here is people that are coming in contact with Christians frequently over time that are slandering them or seeing these really aren't bad people. And those people are the ones you're going to be able to change the perception of. Not all of them, but some of them. But I don't think there's any hope that this is going to change the entire perception. Sure. Sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. I think you're right. Okay, good. Good conversation. So it's interesting here, based on these two verses, he talks about putting away these fleshly lusts, talks about behaving righteously, and he talks about doing good deeds. So you might think in the next, 10, 15 verses here, that he goes into further definition maybe on what these good deeds are. Maybe it's a list of do's and don'ts and ways to get more holy. And there's a lot of different things that could follow this passage, right? So people are watching you. They're going to say evil things about you. It's very interesting, the methodology and the method and where he goes next to these Christians. What does he say? So what is the method that he's suggesting they use beginning in verse 13? He's going to talk about relationships with government, family, other Christians. What is the underlying theme? If you had to sum it up in one word, what does he tell them to do? Submit. You guys must have seen my slides. It's like submit, which is interesting, right? That's a little bit different. He doesn't go through this list of do's and don'ts. He's now trying to articulate how these people are going to be influential. Again, more things that they should do as Christian. But he is putting their conduct on display in front of unbelievers through this act of submission. And we're going to go down through these categories that he talks about. And there's lessons for us in all of this. Again, this is written to us. I'll start with a question. Is submission popular today? That's a rhetorical question. It's not popular at all. I would suggest to you that submission is the opposite of popular. Right? Everyone needs to be empowered, be their own person, not have anyone over you, think your own way, do your own thing, be your own person. I don't even know all the jargon, but that is the flavor of everything in our society, I think pretty much worldwide, but especially here in the United States, submission is viewed as a very, very negative thing. At home, in a family relationship, on a sports team, in relationship to government, all of this is super countercultural to what the society that we live in today. So think about that as we go down through these passages and texts and realize there's some challenges, I think, in here for us. So the first category, the state or the government, what's the methodology? You guys got it. Submit. So let's read verses 13 and 14. I've got a couple questions here that we're going to answer after we read these. Submit yourself for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether to king or as the one in authority, or to governors as set by him for the punishment of evildoers and the praise of those who do right. So what are we to support to and to what extent? Pretty clear. Yeah, government, the leaders that are put there in place. That's kind of the question here at 13 and 14 as well. The authorities and rulers that are put in place. So that was like, that was really easy back then for these Christians, right? They had a great government. No, they didn't have a great government at all, right? Peter is writing to them, telling them, Nero is coming for you. He's now taking this persecution on a roadshow that's been happening in Rome. It's coming to your province. Your governor is going to be getting in good with Nero for persecuting you in extremely severe ways. Okay, so it wasn't that the government was just really great and really easy to submit to. It was the exact opposite of that as well. So think about that today in our own life and our own context. We all have things that we like and dislike about ruling authorities and government. But please never say to yourself, well, it's different now, and it's harder because, or they never had a person like fill in the blank, right? Pick your least favorite person in public office, you know, here in Atlanta or the national stage or whatever. I guarantee you none of them are worse than Nero and the government and the oppression that these people were living under. They were an occupied people with an extremely oppressive, violent government. They were targeting specifically Christians. So as we think about this passage, and really all of these things as well, Peter tells these Christians to submit to government. We're going to see it to families as well and to each other as well. It's never conditional based on both a good government or a bad government. It's always based on where it is at that point in time. I think that's an important point and lesson for us. Comments on that? I've got a couple other passages on this I want to look at. Okay. Romans chapter 13 says a lot about this as well. And we're going to read all these. I think they're really important given the day and age that we live in. Romans chapter 13, beginning in verse 1, let every soul be subject, there's that word again, to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and the authorities that exist are appointed by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authority resists the ordinance of God, and those who resist will bring judgment on themselves. Then he says here in verse 5, therefore you must be subject, not only because of wrath, but also for conscience' sake. For because of this, you pay taxes, and they are God's ministers, attending continually to everything. Render to all their due, taxes to whom taxes are due, customs to whom customs are due, fear to whom fear, and honor to whom honor. So again here, twice, submission and subjection to government. And then there in verse 7, I kind of underlined it, honor to whom honor as well. I think that's also a challenging one as well. Because I can make a pretty strong case that I can be subject to the government. I'm not breaking any laws, but I may struggle with the way I approach my leaders, especially ones I don't like, the way I might talk about them. I may do things that are actually the opposite than bringing honor to them. Over in 1 Timothy, we have a similar thought about this idea of bringing honor, again, with government and those that are in authority. 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 1, therefore I exhort, first of all, that supplications, prayers, intercessions, and giving of thanks be made for all men, for kings, and for all who are in authority. And then Peter even says in himself in 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 17 about honoring the king. So again, I think this is an important set of passages and principles for us here. I don't think we have a bunch of lawless people that are anti-government here in the room. But, you know, from time to time, we may struggle with this idea of honoring and praying for those who are in authority. It's kind of interesting. We think about this passage over in Romans chapter 13 and verse 1. Probably about 10 years ago, I had a chance to do a trip to China where we were evangelizing and studying the Bible with people pretty openly in China at a time period when it's really not technically allowed to be able to do stuff like that. And I thought about this passage. I actually had my marker and my Bible to it. I just thought about it on the plane all the way over there. If I get arrested, I'm just going to pull this out and say, you guys are after the wrong guy. I am in submission and subjective. I'm not trying to overthrow your government at all. Actually, Christians are taught to be in submission to the government in the things that they can be in submission to, right? That's a question often comes up. What if the government tells you to do something that's against God's will? We certainly don't do that. Think about Peter himself over in Acts chapter 4, what they told him. He goes, "Go stop talking about this guy, Jesus." What does Peter say? Should we listen to the government or should we listen to God? We're going to listen to God and we're going to keep doing the things that He's told us to do. So there's certainly limits to this, but I think for the most part we understand what it means. Okay, questions or comments on this? All right, submit. All right. Masters, next. I'm not going to give you the answers on this one. Oops, sorry. What does it say here in, let me get to the right slide, in verse 18 and 20, what are slaves to do to masters? What kind of attitude? Yeah, it's submission again. You guys guessed it, right? And are they supposed to submit to the good masters? Or, like, even the really bad ones? How does that work? Both. How is that fair? I'm supposed to submit to a bad master. Does anyone in here have a, or have ever had a boss they didn't really care about? Maybe a boss that maybe even probably wasn't as nice as they should have been at some point. You may have even had a little mistreatment here. It's different, right? Here, the command is, regardless of who they are, you are supposed to submit. And again, what is the goal in all of this? Glorify God. To glorify God. To show the right example of what you should be doing. Okay, I don't have a lot more comments on that one. I think we get the idea here. Again, there are people, maybe your boss or your manager won't be directly influenced, but potentially other people that you work with might be influenced. If you've ever been in an office setting where there is a manager that's probably not well liked by everyone, and you know, it's break time or water cooler time, and everyone in the office just has something terrible to say about the manager, and you're there as a Christian, do you join in that? Or do you try and bring honor to your manager and do what you're supposed to do or step out of the conversation? I would suggest we should do the latter. You got a comment? Yeah. Yeah. It's very good. I think you do. The sting or the consequence as well. I like that. That's a good point. So we're going to move on unless there's another comment or question here. I'd like us to read the next section. We haven't done a whole lot of reading in this class, and Joel has volunteered to read the first seven verses of 1 Peter chapter 3. Good. Thank you for doing that. So as we go down through our list of things that Peter is asking Christians to submit to, and as we think about this list as well, we started with government, we went to earthly masters, and now we get in these family relationships. I think out of all of these things, this one can be the most challenging, right, for people today. Again, this one is very countercultural because, again, it's very, very personal. It has to do with personal relationships. But the admonitions here are pretty straightforward about submission and the ways that people are supposed to submit to each other. And I would suggest to you here that there's submission also in verse 7 from the man to the wife, and this dwelling and understanding and honoring back to the wife. But again, what is the goal of all of this in this submission between man and wife? It's still to glorify God, and it's also still intended on saving self by glorifying God, but saving other people. In this case, saving the one that we're in a relationship with. Joel, you had a comment. Yeah. Very good. I like that. Especially in the example of marriage as well. So if we think today, there's a lot of reasons why marriages don't last in our culture. I heard today on the radio that January is the peak of filing for divorces. That just kind of shocked me. I'm like, how can you even do that in January? You just came from the holidays and everything. And the commentary on the radio was that people have decided to get out of unhealthy relationships in their New Year's resolution. When I hear that, I don't really understand everyone's circumstance and how they're involved, but I can't help to think that a lot of times in our personal relationships, when things are unhealthy or not working out or incompatible, what does it boil down to? It boils down to me and my will and what I want. And kind of back to this me first idea instead of the other person first. And the other person's salvation as well. That's a tricky one here, but this is certainly something out of all of this is probably the most countercultural to the society that we live in today. But it is the foundation for pleasing God and also pleasing God in this relationship of marriage. Steve, did you have your hand up or are you just scratching? Okay. Anyone have a comment on this one? This is a big one. All right. Let's keep going here. I put the next one up here as well. I will read this one. We talk about duty to other Christians and people around us here. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 8. Finally, so in conclusion here, all of you be of one mind, having compassion for one another, love as brothers, be tenderhearted, be courteous, not returning evil for evil or reviling for reviling, but on the contrary, blessing, knowing that you were called to this, that you may inherit a blessing. So here he's talking about relationships between Christians. And some interesting stuff in this. When we talk about being tenderhearted and courteous. What does being tenderhearted and courteous mean? Kind-hearted and humble, good. Joel, did you have something different? Loving attitude towards others. I think both of those are right. I think this is really talking about how we interact with each other and potentially how we communicate with each other. And he follows that, be courteous in verse 8 with in verse 9, not return evil for evil or reviling for reviling. So I will tell you, I'm not on social media and I don't ever plan on being social media, but I've like looked over my wife's shoulder sometimes and seen people going back and forth, tit for tat, if you will, on social media about things that's certainly not a kind-hearted or courteous manner. And that even if one person is reviled, it seems like we're pretty quick to revile the other person in return very quickly. Janice? First of all, Janice, are you on social media? No, I didn't think you were. All right, go ahead. Insult for insult, yeah. Yeah. Insult. Yeah, we seem to couch our words sometimes, though, where I'm not really sure. You say, well, I didn't insult the person. I just said everything they said was stupid and ignorant, right? And showed it was wrong. So, and they did it to me, so it's evil for evil, basically. Jack. Yeah. Yes. Kind of people you should be, yeah. Very good. Very good, by that action. He's kind of saying, same team here, right? So he's talking brother to brother here. Be kind, be courteous. If someone does evil to you, don't do evil back, right? What happens? You get in this perpetual cycle. If someone reviles you or takes you down a notch, don't revile them. We just all get weaker as a team. Mike? Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Okay. Very good. Yes. Very good. Yeah, I like your point. It says right in the verse, you are called to do this. This is part of our inheritance. It also gives kind of a positive to the negative here as well, right? It says, not evil for evil, not reviling for reviling. But it says, on the contrary, a blessing. So we can build each other up. It is possible. You can build someone up, even if they have reviled you and spoke evil of you or done something. That may be one of the best opportunities to build someone up and be a blessing for that person rather than a curse. Yes, in the back. Yes. Very good. Thank you for that. Okay. So, like I said, that's the first thing I thought about when I read this verse. If you struggle with that or know people that struggle with that, please don't just cut and paste this verse and say, you're doing wrong, right? That's kind of what this verse says not to do. But this is something that we can use as a tool to talk about how we are courteous and tenderhearted. We are a family, right? And things break down in a family when we start being discourteous and unkind to each other, right? In a church family and like a personal family too, right? When mom and dad have had a long day at work, the kids aren't talking the right way, we're not honoring people, we know this is not the right way that we should live as a family. So we shouldn't live like that as a church family either. So you guys got that. All right, so we're going to end on one of my big charts, and this goes in the packet of charts as well. So if we put all of this together, all these relationships and all these groups that live around us and all these groups that we're part of, the first one here is government. And hopefully you got that one pretty clearly. There's clearly an element of submission, of obeying, but there's also an element of honoring. And why would we do that? Well, I got my animation out of sorts, so we'll have to just keep going this way. Employment. Hopefully all of us are employed. If you're not employed and you're retired, congratulations. But we should be in subjection to our employer. We should exercise some patience even when we might be mistreated and when we've actually done nothing wrong as well. Family relationship, we talked about this. Wives with pure conduct, meekness. Husbands dwelling with understanding and bringing honor to their wives. And then people that are around us here in the brotherhood, in our Christian family, that we should strive to be like-minded, compassionate. We should be humble. We certainly should be loving each other. And that we should return a blessing for any evil. None of us are perfect. But if there is something that's done against you or revilement or something evil, let's please return it with a blessing. And there's us in the middle of it. And kind of the reasons that we went through here, this interaction with government is for the Lord and for the Lord's sake. For the employer is for, again, for conscience toward God and to be acceptable for God. And I'll just put the rest of them up here. All the reasons. This is going to be in your lovely packet of Blaine's complicated slides that you'll get. I've actually got a preview of all three of them here that you'll get. Summarizes everything. All right. Lesson 5 on Sunday. I'm going to get into that pesky subject of persecution. Thank you.